Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to bridging the gap between adventure and adventurer by helping people select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins.
I just want to say one word to you. Just one word.
Yes, sir.
Are you listening?
Yes, sir, yeah.
Plastics.
Exactly, how do you mean?
There's a great future in plastics. Think about it. Will you think about it?
Yes, I will.
I've said, that's a deal.
In 1967, when the film The Graduate was released, that seemed like good advice. Plastics were coming into their own. There seemed to be no end to what plastic could do or the new uses to be found for them. There was no downside. That realization came later. Consumers loved replacing their glass shampoo bottles with plastic bottles that wouldn't break in the shower if dropped. Manufacturers liked working with plastic because it was inexpensive, moldable, could be used for nearly everything, and it reduced the weight of products. But slowly, over time, we realized that plastic lasts forever. And because it was cheap, we were fine with just throwing it away and having it disappear into landfills. But some of that plastic escaped our grasp and ended up flooding natural areas and waterways and interfering seriously with nature and wildlife. That's one reason most municipalities started recycling programs. But in truth, only 9% of all the plastic ever produced, 9%, has ever been recycled. So today we talk about the impact of that reality, how plastics are wreaking havoc on wildlife, and how this has become a global problem in search of a global solution, but one in which each of us has a role to play. Dr. Jenna Jambach is a National Geographic Fellow and Associate Professor in the College of Engineering at the University of Georgia and internationally recognized for her research on plastic waste in the ocean. And she joins us via Skype from Athens, Georgia. Good morning and welcome.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. Laura Parker is a staff writer for National Geographic who specializes in covering climate change and marine environments and is reporting on National Geographic's Planet or Plastic series to raise awareness about the global plastic trash crisis. She is with us by phone from Washington, D.C. Thank you for being here.
Yes, and thanks for having me.
You're very
glad to be doing this.
Great. And here in our Spirit Square studio, we welcome back Jeff Smithberger. He's the director of solid waste for Mecklenburg County. Prior to that, he ran a similar operation in Fairfax County, Virginia, a suburb of Washington. Welcome to you. Welcome back.
Good morning. Thank you.
If you'd like to join our conversation, you can do it by getting to us through email at charlottetalks@wfa.org. Search for WFA on Facebook. Get to us through Twitter at Charlotte Talks. Jenna, let me begin with you. Before plastic bottles were all the rage, bottles were made from glass. Before plastic television set and computer monitors, well, televisions particularly, they were encased in wooden cabinets. Before plastic, groceries were carried home in paper bags. Before plastics, we drank out of water fountains instead of carrying plastic water bottles with us. Except for the water fountain example, we threw all that stuff away at some point in time. So why is throwing plastic away so much worse than throwing glass or wood or some other metal material away?
That's a great question. You know, plastic is a different material. Some of those materials you also mentioned don't biodegrade, but one thing about plastics, which it doesn't biodegrade as well, so it pretty much, as far as our practicality, lasts indefinitely. We also find that without having some value at end of life, many times those glass bottles were reused, it ends up leaking into our environment. And that's where it's been impacting our ecosystems and oceans around the world.
I was actually surprised to find when I was reading yesterday that plastics have been around since the late 1800s. I thought they were a 20th century invention, but I guess the 20th century was when they discovered they could make plastic profitably out of oil-based products. When plastic was starting to come really into vogue in the 1950s and building through the 60s and 70s and 80s, did the plastics industry know that this would happen, this pollution, this impossible problem of not being able to ever get rid of this stuff? Did they know that was going to happen, or was this just an unintended consequence?
I don't think they knew. I mean, I think partly why they were using this material is that people were replacing some natural materials. It was providing convenience for a society that was quickly evolving. You know, I don't think they gave much thought to the waste management of products. And I find that a lot sort of working in the research. And I'm sure Jeff has found this too. You know, we get whatever comes down the pipe for us to manage. And that's a real challenge when people aren't thinking about designing products for recycling or for easy waste management.
And when I talked, Laura, about your being a reporter for National Geographic's Planet or Plastic series, I talked about the reason for that series being to raise awareness about what you describe, what they describe at National Geographic as a crisis. How serious is this?
Well, if we go back a little bit in the history, the plastic production really took off after World War II. Mm-hmm. And when much of the consumer products were made, and it just has accelerated ever since then, and to the point where now 40% of the market is disposable single-use plastics. And another shocking figure I'll throw at you is that about half or just less than half of the plastic on Earth today was made in the last 15 years. Most of a lot of the growth has happened in developing nations on the other side of the world that lack the waste management capacity to pick up the trash, and there we are today.
So if half of the plastic ever made has been made in the last 15 years, are we finding more uses for it, or are we just wrapping everything in plastic now at the retail level, and that's what's causing that?
Well, a combination of both. There are new plastic products that are invented all of the time, and there will be more new products that will be invented after we're finished with this conversation this morning. And a lot of it also is where, you know, if you go to a grocery store today, and you will see, especially in the produce department, a lot of cut-up fruit that's wrapped up, a lot of other plastic encasing food that wasn't done maybe a decade ago or 15 years ago. That's just one example. It preserves the freshness of the produce, but we're seeing a lot of stuff encased in plastic.
I actually never thought about this, but you buy a package of strawberries, or you buy some blueberries, or you go to the salad bar at the local grocery store, Jeff, and you'll put it usually in a plastic container, which is you use long enough to carry it home, consume whatever you've bought, and you toss it, hopefully in the recycling, if it's recyclable plastic. Would it be better from your point of view, as somebody who has to deal with this stuff, if these containers were made out of something else, like cardboard?
Absolutely, positively. And we tried to work with manufacturers, and we work with a group called the Product Stewardship Institute, because people want to do the right thing. However, we're not giving many choices from the manufacturers about doing the right
thing. Well, it's not just the manufacturers, it seems to me. It's the retailers. I mean, is it because we, as consumers, like the fact that we can look at our fresh strawberries through this clear plastic as opposed to having it covered up by a piece of cardboard?
Absolutely. I mean, that's why they do it that way. It's based on marketing 101. You were able to see how beautiful and fresh the blueberries or the strawberries are, whereas in a cardboard container, well, it's just up to you to figure out when you get home if they're fresh or not.
Which is worse, these plastic containers that you have at the grocery stores, or some stores have now begun to use cardboard containers, but they appear to have a plastic coating on the food surface so it doesn't absorb into the cardboard, which is worse?
Both are pretty bad for an end-of-life situation. Many of the companies that we deal with and we talk to deal with manufacturing and shipping, but they never, ever, ever consider end-of-life. And that's where I get involved, is our facilities and infrastructure is all about the end of life of something. And we try our best to find a home for something that's end of life, but we find many times, because of the different formulations of plastics, we're now finding something that's really strange, is that folks that used to have a pure plastic are now blending it with different plastics. So even though it may look like a polystyrene, or it may look like an LDPE, and I'm throwing out some words,
yes, that are over my head already.
Linear low density polyethylene. There are about seven basic types of plastics. And manufacturers are blending them together because they have now figured out that we like the texture and the way that these things feel. They're great for marketing. They're great for the product. They're great for shipping. But they're absolutely horrendous for the recycling end of the things that we try to do.
Because you can't separate them?
You can't separate them. And then there's nobody that wants them on the back end, because when somebody recycles something, I'll use an aluminum can for the example. The aluminum can is pretty much an aluminum can. It can be smelted down and reused. But when we get a piece of plastic something, it is generally many different types of thermoplastics put together. There is not an end use for it. It cannot be easily remelted down and reused again. Now, we are looking into some plastics to fuel situations, but what we're finding, the economics of doing that is just not sustainable.
So, Jenna, you are famous around the world for helping compile some significant statistics about plastic, the most staggering of which to me was the fact that you say we have produced 8 billion, with a B, metric tons of plastic since 1950 and have only recycled 9% of it. Put that 8 billion metric tons into perspective. How can we understand that number?
It's really hard to. You know, we did convert that over into something like 80 million blue whales, but you can't even really imagine that. I mean, it's really challenging to imagine the weight and the volume of that much material. But something I have done in some of my classes is have my students record everything they touch in a day that's plastic. And that is really tangible and sort of eye-opening. And it sort of illustrates maybe sort of your love-hate feeling for this material, because I think you can't imagine how your day would go maybe without some of those items, and what they do for you and what they do for society. And yet at the same time, we know of all of these, you know, all of these issues, including the fact that of that 8 billion, 6.4 billion has become waste that we've had to manage. And then you correctly stated about 9.5% of that only around the globe has been recycled. And then, of course, we have the quantity that's leaking into the ocean. And that is 8 million metric tons per year.
That's a good experiment for people who are listening to us right now. Just look around wherever you are. Doesn't matter where you are. Look around and take an inventory of everything that you see or touch that's made of plastic. In this room that we are sitting in right now, the computer monitor bezels and stands are plastic. The chairs that we're sitting on are plastic. The formica, I guess, on top of this table is a form of plastic. The wrapping around the edge of the formica is plastic. The knobs on the controls are plastic. The computer cabinets are plastic. Little pieces of the microphone stand are plastic. The headphones are plastic. I mean, it just goes on and on and on. Could anyone have predicted, besides the guy from The Graduate that we just played, that plastic would become as ubiquitous as it has become?
You know, I think it has been, you know, I think they knew it was going to be super useful because it was the first time there was this material that could really be molded and colored and textured. And, you know, so I don't know that they could have predicted, you know, where we are now, but I think right away people, you know, saw how useful it was. And then that's only expanded as chemists have been able to manipulate this material and polymers themselves even more.
And therein lies the rub and the problem in the oceans, which we're going to talk extensively about as we go through this hour. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that believe a car is used for more than just getting from place to place. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Jenna Jembeck is with us. She's a National Geographic Fellow and Associate Professor of Environmental Engineering at the University of Georgia. Jeff Smithberger is with us in our studio. He's Director of Solid Waste for Mecklenburg County. And Laura Parker is a staff writer for National Geographic. Laura, is the problem here the ubiquity that virtually everything we touch in the world today contains something made of plastic, or the fact that it just doesn't go away when we're done with it? Which is the bigger problem?
I'm not sure we can say which is the bigger problem. Both are true. And to make a couple of points here, plastic has changed the world and has made life possible for us, the life that we live. And plastic is not going to go away from our lives. I mean, their medical devices save lives. Airplanes and cars are lighter weight, saving fuel, and so on and so on. The focus of our effort at National Geographic, which is to both educate our readers as to the developments as they happen, and they're happening fairly rapidly now, and also to get them to think about their own plastic use. The focus of all of that is on single-use plastics, and this is something that will happen at the sort of macro level. Industry has to make some decisions about what they want to do and what their role is in this, and I think we've seen in the last year that quite a number of companies have woken up to what's happened and are trying to figure out various ways to redesign their products or to use more recycled material, and so on and so forth. And then we can go down to the individual consumer level. Our Planet for Plastic project launched last June when we published the issue that sort of gave everyone an introduction to Plastics 101, what's happened and where this is headed. And part of that included asking our readers to take a pledge to look at their own use. As Jenna mentioned, when she has her students look around at what they touch every year with plastic, we are doing something similar with our readers that say, is there a way for you to reduce your own use, even if it's something small?
But, I mean, can we? Because, I mean, at the grocery store, you can say paper instead of plastic for the bag you carry.
You can say paper instead of plastic. You can get a reusable bag. You don't need to buy necessarily bags that are made for trash bags in your bathroom. You can use the plastic bag that you carried your groceries home with as a bag. You can get a reusable bottle. There are many, many ways for people to assess their use and figure out a smarter way to use it. And as I said, industry is going to play a big role in here. And, there are some products, single-use products, that probably should just go away. And I think the companies are figuring out what those are.
And what are? Give me an example. Give me an example of a product that should just go away.
Okay. So let's go to the food delivery area or takeout food. If you're in a restaurant and you're dining in the restaurant, you don't need to be given plastic utensils. If you're going to take your food home, you don't need to have plastic utensils. If you're going to go to a picnic table in a park, someone needs to give you plastic utensils. That's a very small example, but there's a rethink that we need to do on how much of this do we really need, and what should we do about it? And as I said, that's a tiny example, but that's the start. And to go back to our earlier conversation was about a lot about recycling and trash, and all of that is at the bottom end of the stream or downstream. And we really, both Jeff and Jenna mentioned this, but we really need to go back further upstream and not only look at do we need this, but how can it be redesigned so that it perhaps uses less plastic in the manufacture of it, and how can it be wisely collected at the end of its life and remade into something else.
So in the 80s, we saw photographs of the of portions, because you can't take a photograph of all of it. It's impossible, of this huge floating island of plastic in the middle of the Pacific that some people said was the size of Texas. And we've seen stories and read stories about sea animals washing up on the shore, and when they are autopsied, their stomachs are full of plastic. We've seen pictures of beaches covered with detritus that's all made of plastic. In 2015, Jenna, you conducted a groundbreaking study outlining where all this plastic comes from, because a lot of people said people are throwing this stuff overboard from ships. That's not true. Where does it come from?
Yeah, so we conducted some research looking at mismanaged solid waste on land, so mismanaged municipal waste, and we looked at 192 countries in the world that have a coastline, because we wanted to estimate how much of this was actually reaching the ocean, and we looked at the per-person waste generation rate, so how much waste someone's producing every day, the quantity of that that's plastic, and then from there, the quantity that's mismanaged, and that was either inadequately managed, so inadequate infrastructure in that area, or littered, as we sometimes see people do. And then from there, we had three scenarios of what could actually make it to the ocean. And our mid-estimate for that research was that 8 million metric tons was reaching the oceans every year. Again, a hard number to imagine. So let's imagine us all standing hand to hand, covering the entire coastline of the world, looking out at the ocean. Each one in front of us would have 5 grocery size bags filled with plastic, and that's what we estimate is going in every year.
But is it coming from all over the world? I mean, are people on the Mediterranean, in France and Italy, throwing plastic bottles into the Mediterranean? Are people in England throwing them into the English Channel? Are we throwing them into the Atlantic and Pacific and the Gulf of Mexico? Or is it coming from a specific area of the world?
So there's so what we did is we looked at influencing factors because this has it has both geographic variation and temporal variation. And it really was highly dependent on where you saw adequate waste management infrastructure. And so a lot of rapidly developing middle income countries around the world were seeing this increase in economic growth. And then along with that comes this increase in waste generation, including plastic. But then the infrastructure to manage that plastic lags behind. And so that's where we saw a lot of plastic leaking out. However, the U.S., for example, was in the list of top 20, and I feel like I can call that country out because I'm a U.S. citizen. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we're there because we produce so much waste per person. Many of these countries that are rapidly developing are still producing very little waste per person, but we produce 3 to 4 times as much per person. So even a small amount of leakage from us then had this contribution. So I think it's important to understand those factors.
From what I read yesterday, a lot of this stuff is coming from Asia, Vietnam, China particularly, and other countries. And there's a little irony in there because for the longest time, China has taken in a lot of the world's plastic to be recycled. And yet they don't seem to have a infrastructure for their own citizens to recycle their own materials. Would that be accurate?
Yeah, you know, they were as the manufacturing hub of the world, and we published some research on this as well, for 28 years, you know, importing the material. And they did. They had an operation to be able to take that material in and get that to manufacturing facilities, but had not been able to develop the internal infrastructure. Now, with the ban that they instituted this past year, or the end of 2017, they have now started really developing and sourcing a lot of their material domestically as well as importing industrial pellets still.
So quick questions here now for Jeff Smithberger, who's the director of solid waste here in Mecklenburg County. Why did the county start a recycling program? Was it to make money, or was it because we had a genuine concern about and a genuine need to recycle because all this stuff was filling the landfills?
the latter. It's the fact that we were filling landfills up. We had
Why is that a problem? Just because there's not enough land to go around, enough landfill area?
Well, let's face it. If I come knocking at your door and say, hey, I want to build a new landfill in your community, I'm not welcomed with open arms. And so it is very difficult to site and design a new landfill facility. So we try to cherish and keep the ones that we have for those things that we just absolutely don't have ability to recycle anything.
But Mecklenburg County, as I understand, is one of the few municipalities that has its own recycling processing center.
That is correct.
Why?
Most of the times, the recycling processing centers are owned by large corporations. We are one of the few communities in the United States that have chosen to own our own, and therefore we control our own destiny because we can decide what we're going to take in, and we are not in the for-profit business. And I'm not saying there's anything wrong with for-profit businesses, but those folks do things for a monetary bottom line. We do things for a sustainability industry that we work with. And so I'm not concerned if I can't make a certain profit on a certain material. I'm concerned that I am keeping things out of a landfill, that my sustainability factor is the fact that we're not putting things back into a landfill facility.
Despite our recycling efforts here and around the country, I'm sure that a lot of plastic ends up being collected as trash and then sent to a landfill. How much recyclable plastic would you say ends up in Mecklenburg County landfills that could have gone to you?
We did a trash sort study about 3 years ago, and in that study we found that we had about 20% materials that could be recycled again. And of that 20%, about 12% would have been plastic material.
So are things you just held up an aluminum can as an example when I was talking to Laura about how, decisions that consumers could make. Don't buy the bottled soft drink, buy it in a can because the aluminum can is recyclable. Is it infinitely recyclable?
You mean the aluminum can?
Yeah.
There's a limit to everything in the world, but it is a lot better to recycle the aluminum than it is something that's plastic. And I had a conversation with somebody who's in the bottling industry about 3 months ago, and I said, why do you make your sodas both in an aluminum can and a plastic bottle?
And why do they?
And they said, the consumers demand it. And they said they want the screw on top on the bottle.
And why can't they put a screw on top? They do put the screw on tops now on top of aluminum cans. Why can't they do that?
Well, absolutely. Absolutely, Mike, they can.
Because the bottles do not hold carbonated beverages for the same amount of time that glass or cans do. They get flat in the plastic.
And I agree with that. But they're telling me that they have a marketing staff, and their marketing staff determines how many bottles that they're going to run and how many aluminum cans that they're going to run. So, and it's based upon the consumers buying it.
So Chris emails, how many times can glass, paper, and plastic materials be recycled? What is the degradation, and how does that determine what products can subsequently be produced until we arrive at an item that cannot be recycled?
Each one of those have a different life factor, and it depends upon what life they're using. If there are, if the material is supposed to be a beverage container, it's going to be different than it's going to be, I'm trying to think of an industrial use for something. And so we try to look at the items that we have an available market for, and right now there is a robust market for aluminum cans. There is not so much of a robust market for PETE bottles. We have a hard time finding vendors that want to take it all. One of the reasons why is we don't get it in a pristine state. The things that we get are post-consumer. If we could get it pre-consumer, there's a greater market for it, but we don't. And trying to
They're not going to make it just so you can recycle it.
No. I get that. But keep in mind that, you know, we ask for things to be clean, dry, and loose.
Yeah.
Very few times do we get something that's clean or dry. And then the loose part is when they're putting it inside of a plastic bag.
Now, Jenna, I'm told you like to crawl around landfills. And sometimes you take other people with you. God knows how you get them to go. But in a conversation with NPR, you pointed out that in a landfill, microbes work to degrade food and other organic garbage. Metals corrode and dissolve. You say everything returns to the earth except plastic. What is it about plastic? It's a product of oil which came from the earth. Mm-hmm. What is it about plastic that refuses to decay? Because I have put things in the attic in plastic garbage bags for storage, mm-hmm. and 2 years later go and pick them up, and they just fall apart in my hands.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, so the carbon in a polymer is in these long chain carbon compounds, and so it's really hard for microbes to actually access that carbon like they can in other materials. And but what we do see, though, is because the molecules, the carbon itself isn't being consumed, but the plastic can get brittle. So it like oxidizes when it's exposed to air, and that makes it brittle. And especially like the film plastic, the bags you're talking about, those will kind of feel like they're disintegrating. But all it's doing is breaking up into smaller and smaller pieces. And that's what we see happening in our environment and in our oceans. It fragments. It's called microplastic. And that's another one of the reasons plastic is so different as a material.
Laura, you wrote, I think it was an article for National Geographic, in which you said that if plastic had been invented when the Pilgrims came to America and the Mayflower had been stocked with bottled water and plastic-wrapped snacks, their plastic trash would likely still be around today, four centuries later. Does this stuff ever decay? Ever? Or do we know?
Well, we haven't been around for 400 years since plastic was invented. The point is both what Jenna and Jeff have said. It doesn't break down, and so there's a lot of work being done now to invent a biodegradable plastic or a compostable plastic. We are sort of signaling a great caution on this for people who think that this is the answer to all their problems or to the world's problem on plastic. Because for a variety of reasons, and I don't want to take up the rest of the hour with this, but people should not get the idea, well, I can just toss this aside. You know, let's just throw it in the ocean because it'll eventually biodegrade. Right now, there is no biodegradable product that will biodegrade in the ocean because the oceans are too cold. Compostable products generally need to be composted in an industrial composter, and not all people or communities have access to that. And so while we're still talking about the back end of plastics, there are some really large questions that need to be asked and pursued, and I think they're being pursued. But let me sort of frame it in a different way.
In 20 seconds.
Right now, today, 2 billion people on this planet lack access to waste management systems. Plastic production is expected to double by 2050. Those two things don't square right, because by 2050, it'll be, I think, 3 billion people who lack access to waste management systems.
Laura Parker writes for National Geographic. Jenna Jembeck is an associate professor in environmental engineering at the University of Georgia. And Jeff Smithberger runs the solid waste here in Mecklenburg County. We're coming right back. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about plastic today and the fact that it's all around us. It never goes away. And it's causing significant problems in nature around the world. Jenna Jembeck is one of the leading researchers in that area of this conversation. She's a National Geographic Fellow and an Associate Professor of Environmental Engineering at the University of Georgia. Laura Parker writes about this constantly for National Geographic and their Planet or Plastics series. And Jeff Smithberger is with us. He is the Director of Solid Waste in Mecklenburg County, and he informs me that in the fall, you do not need to use plastic leaf bags. You can use craft paper, and Mecklenburg County gives that away in the fall.
We do. We encourage people not to use plastic bags because it's not good for our composting process. There are a number of alternatives to not use a plastic bag. We give away about 75 to 80,000 craft paper bags. And there's a local company here called Leaf Burrito, and they have a really unique product that can be used to bring leaves to the curb. So there are many ways that people can not use plastics. They just got to take an extra 10 or 15 seconds to think about things and try it a different way.
Okay. So, Jenna, plastic is all around us. We've established that, and maybe you can't answer the question, but what kinds of plastic products are most frequently found in the wild, the ones that are washing up on beaches in that island in the middle of the Pacific and in animals.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, we do know there's over 30 years the Ocean Conservancy has organized this international coastal cleanup. We have a mobile app called Marine Debris Tracker that people all over the world report to us what they find. And as you heard Laura refer to single-use plastic items before, that is what we are finding. So plastic bags, water bottles, bottle caps, cigarette butts are actually the number one item because most people don't realize that the filters inside them are cellulose acetate, which is a polymer. And food wrappers. Food wrappers have been just progressively moving up this list. And I have been in like eight countries in the past six weeks. And just that is what I've been seeing tremendously. Snack items, wrappers from those all over.
Now, there are going to be people listening who say, okay, so there are a couple Coke bottles floating around in the middle of the Pacific, or maybe you'll go down as a deep diver or you'll send a sub down and you'll find that there's plastic debris on the ocean floor. The oceans are vast. There's far more ocean than there is land on the globe. Why is this such a problem?
Mm-hmm. You know, you're right. The oceans are really vast. And in fact, before plastic was around, people were using waterways and watercourses to dispose of waste. But why is it so different now that, you know, plastic is there? So in the ocean, there's all kinds of things. Microbes colonize plastic and then it smells like food to seabirds. So ingestion and entanglement are two of the most widely known about impacts to animals. So animals ingest plastic. If it doesn't pass through their system, they feel full. They starve to death. And we see this a lot in seabirds. A lot of whales recently have been washing up on shores and plastic bags have been found in their stomachs. Sea turtles mistake plastic bags for jellyfish. We also know plastics sorb persistent organic pollutants. So if those are in the environment, then they sorb to the plastic and the plastic can transport those into animals and around the world and transport invasive species. So it has all of these interactions with our environment, and many of them we really don't know the full sort of impact of what they're having.
And although everything you've just talked about is harmful, it's one thing to have plastic bottles and plastic bags floating in the sea environment and having animals ingest them. But there's the danger that also comes from something called microplastics, Laura. What are they and why are they harmful?
Microplastics are created when plastic products in the ocean break down from wave action and sunlight. And they become, they're essentially the pieces of plastic that are about the size of a grain of rice. In or smaller, and they continue to break down into what's known now as nanoplastics. So they keep getting smaller and smaller, and these are things that also are consumed by fish and birds and so on, and all small organisms in the ocean. We published a story in the current issue, the May issue, about research that is going on in Hawaii of fish nurseries, which are areas off the coast of the islands where larval fish spend the first few weeks of their life. And they discovered that these larval fish are eating nanoplastics as sometimes their first meal. And at that stage of life, when 99% of larval fish don't make it anyway, which is by natural design, now we've man has introduced a new element here, which is plastic. And so the question is unanswered, but are we affecting fish populations and the ability of fish population to reach the size it's supposed to reach in order to become food for larger fish or grow into fish themselves? Are we upsetting that balance now because larval fish are eating nanofibers as their first meal?
And let's stay in Hawaii for a second, because I read something I think you wrote yesterday that really shocked me. You say it is estimated that on the big island of Hawaii, as much as 15% of the sand on the beaches is actually grains of microplastic.
Yeah, that's not on all of the beaches. That's just been found in some areas. It depends on where the beaches are on the islands. And but this was a study done by some scientists who were paying attention to what was coming off the Pacific Gyre. And you made reference to this floating island in the center of the Pacific Gyre earlier. It's not really an island. If you sailed out there, you wouldn't see anything. There's just nothing to stand on. It's just, think of it more as a soup. There's a lot of fishing gear out there, but there's also a lot of microplastics, and these things work their way onto the beach and then get embedded into the beach in various places with various concentrations, and that depending on how much is embedded, it could affect things like sand temperature or how quickly water, the composition of the beach, how does water flow through it, that in turn can affect nesting of sea turtles. The sex, the gender of a sea turtle is determined by the temperature of the sand and how long the egg incubates. So it could ultimately, if it were to get bad enough, if the microplastics were to be abundant enough, it could effectively affect the gender of sea turtles.
So this really affects so many things that we don't even think about, and the ocean breaks down this plastic to this invisible level, and that gets into the beaches, it gets into the food supply of the fishes that just suck in vast amounts of water, and they think they're full, but they're not, because they're full of plastic, and there's no nutritional value to that whatsoever. The world has this recycling system. Most places, most civilized places in the world have recycling infrastructure. We certainly do here. But you were on this program not too long ago, or maybe a year or so ago, Jeff, and we talked about how the recycling system is breaking down if it's not already broken. How would you characterize it?
Recycling has certainly changed from a marketing standpoint. Many of our consumers are confused about what they can and can't recycle. Many think that anything made of plastic, from a child's car seat to a soccer ball, are recyclable, and that just isn't necessarily the case. We're trying to educate people about the choices that they make and the things that they procure, as well as their end-of-life situation and what we can and can't recycle. We are on the downstream end. We are sort of hamstrung by what manufacturers make things out of. We try to encourage manufacturers to make things out of things that we can easily recycle. High-density polyethylene. If you think about your laundry detergent bottle, it's generally high-density polyethylene. If you think about your milk one-gallon jug, it's a type of plastic that we can easily recycle. But if manufacturers make things out of things that we can't utilize and find a market for, we're caught in the middle. People get mad at us. The recycling markets have changed, and from a for-profit situation, it's not as advantageous to be in that business.
The economics don't work anymore. Why not?
Well, the economics don't work. One of the reasons is because if people are using food-grade things, such as a water bottle, that water bottle is not going to get turned into a water bottle again when it gets recycled. It's going to be a plastic something. It's going to be floor covering. It might be a shirt, but it doesn't go back to the same thing.
So some areas have banned plastic grocery bags. Not all, but some. How serious are they? Can they be recycled?
Oh, absolutely. Okay. Absolutely.
As we've been sitting here talking, you pointed out that on one of the telephone wires across the street from the window that we're looking through right here is a Mylar balloon. There was a festival downtown a couple of weeks ago, and one of those Mylar balloons, I guess, got caught up in the wires, and it's been there ever since. And it's going to be there till the wind blows it away, and then God knows where it will go. Is that recyclable?
Mylar balloons are generally not recyclable anywhere.
Then why are they allowed to be manufactured?
That's a great question for the folks in the political world. You had mentioned that there are certain plastic bag bans, but one of the things that I have noticed is that the plastic bag bans, when they are enacted, generally get overturned. If you look at North Carolina, North Carolina's Outer Bank areas had a plastic bag ban. That was overturned. South Carolina's has been overturned. Alabama's has been overturned. And so the legislative groups pass legislation, and then there are lobbyist groups that come in and say, hey, we really need to make these again.
So, Jenna, I don't know whether you can answer this question, but Do you know that when, if politicians are presented with this, or with when companies are presented with the knowledge that this Mylar balloon that's hanging up there on that telephone wire cannot be recycled, it's going to last forever, is there any will to either ban them or for the manufacturers to say, we're not going to make this anymore, or is it all on the backs of consumers to say, that's not recyclable, I'm not buying it, and therefore the market will crash?
No, well, I think governments, companies and corporations and citizens all need to come together on this issue. And governments are going to be passing policies. You know, places like Hawaii, we were talking about that, have basically all the counties in Hawaii, so they basically have a plastic bag ban for the state, and specifically, you know, those blow away. They are difficult to manage in the solid waste stream. They can be recycled, but usually not in your curbside bin. And they cause actually a lot of tangles at materials recovery facilities. And I'm sure Jeff could elaborate. But so there's other problems with certain materials and products outside of the ocean. And so, yeah, I mean, you know, sometimes it takes a policy. Companies are waking up to this issue because they know if something can't be recycled, it typically has less value and is more likely to leak out. They're trying to use more recycled materials in the packaging that they're producing. And then the citizens try to make choices, but I think we do know that it's very confusing because the plastic space is quite complex, and we talked about sort of the blends of materials. Yeah. Partly what we need to do is collect sort of baseline information to inform, I think, governments, and that's something we're doing with National Geographic on our Sea to Source expeditions and trying to get this data and information to communities and to decision makers so that they can figure out what the next steps to do are.
So let me go through some questions that have come through from listeners while we've been talking here. Kate on Twitter, excuse me, how can we truly make a significant impact in education in order to make a dramatic shift in future use and consumption? Where is the fight? What can we do to get boots on the ground to help? I'm not sure which one of you can answer that. Jeff?
I think
Laura, go ahead. Go ahead.
That's part of why we launched this campaign. It was to educate our readers. We have an enormous reach across the world with not only the magazine and its more than 30 foreign language editions, but also on social media and on our website, which publishes daily news, including our work on plastics. A lot of schools are starting it. I think legislative branches in various states are educating themselves. There are a lot of NGOs who are trying to bring attention to this issue, and the industry itself has awakened to what's going on and what the solutions need to be. But there are a lot of really, really difficult questions that need to be answered, one of which on plastic bags is it's cheaper to make new bags out of virgin plastic than it is to collect them all again and ship them back to the bag factory and remake them, melt them down and make them into something new. That's just one example. So for every answer we may come up with right today, there will be five more questions that need to be asked.
So I have a minute left, and Tom emails, the discussion appears to be centered on the food industry, and we have talked a lot about food packaging. Hardware, drug, other hard goods vendors use a lot of plastic, especially on small things that they want to make difficult to steal. If you try to buy a printer cartridge, it's going to be an impossible to open cardboard wrapped in plastic. Where consumers seem to be at the we're captured in this. We can't do anything about that, can we?
Well, I tell folks to please send an email. We all have voices. Everyone has a smartphone and an account. Send an email to the manufacturers that are making these things. Let them know that you don't like it.
Okay. And does the county have, Leanne on Facebook, does the county plan to do any kind of campaign to better educate citizens about all of this?
Great question. Thanks for that one. But yes, wipeoutwaste.com is our website in the county, wipeoutwaste.com. We are taking out billboard ads, television ads. We're trying to reach folks. Let them know.
That's Jeff Smithberger, who's the director of solid waste for Mecklenburg County. Also joining us, one of the leading scientists in the world on discovering how bad the situation is, General Jembeck, National Geographic Fellow, Associate Professor of Environmental Engineering at the University of Georgia, and Laura Parker, staff writer for National Geographic. Thank you all for the hour. Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to helping customers select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.